I wonder how far back you can remember in terms of radio programmes.
And I wonder, have you ever thought about the origins of the type of programmes available from all the different radio stations around today?
Well, commercial radio broadcasting in Europe goes back far beyond the era of the local commercial radio stations currently engulfing Britain, or even the pirate stations of the 60s.
You see, in the 1930s, thousands of people tuned to broadcasts in English directed to us from the continent by such stations as Poste Parisienne, Radio Luxembourg and Radio Normandy.
So Dave Howell and I, Alan Thompson, are here to unravel the history of that period of broadcasting in this programme, Searching the Ether.
We've crammed it with historic information, snippets from the original stations, music of the era, and lots of well-known personalities relating their part in the story.
So, let's retune our dials just a few years.
Just heard the voices of the Bells of Normandy introducing another broadcast from Radio Normandy Calling, the great touring stage show coming to you tonight from the stage of the Alhambra Theatre, Bradford.
This is Radio Luxembourg on our new frequency, 208 metres on the medium wave band.
This programme is sent to you by Huntley & Palmer's, makers of biscuits and cakes. It is especially designed so that each week our programs will present to you the changes that have taken place in music during the past 100 years. We were starting our series with a selection of music composed about the same time as Huntley and Palmer started their factory 100 years ago. Now bear in mind that Huntley and Palmer's stand for quality. And like the music of the famous composers of their time, they are still supreme. We'll commence our concert with our signature tune, Music Through the Ages.
Music through the ages, like the blessings heaven sends.
The popular music of the day. But the story of commercial wireless goes back further than the 30s. The earliest programme, it seems, was broadcast in 1925 from Radio Paris, who at that time were broadcasting from the dizzy heights of the Eiffel Tower. The show consisted of a fashion talk in English and was sponsored by Selfridges. Unfortunately, the transmission received no advance publicity and only three people ever wrote in to say they'd heard it.
2 years later, Hilversum Radio, near Amsterdam, broadcast a concert which was intended for an audience in the United Kingdom. And this was the first of a series sponsored by Colster Brand, manufacturers of radio equipment. But it was in the 1930s that Europe had its biggest ever commercial radio boom. An enterprising gent by the name of Captain L.F. Plug, who had miraculously got away with that English broadcast from the Eiffel Tower, formed a company aptly named the International Broadcasting Company, or IBC.
IBC later rented airtime from Radio Normandy. By the end of 1932, no less than 21 British firms were sponsoring the programmes of light music and variety. Money was flowing like a cool mountain stream, with an equally cool £400,000 being spent in 1935, which had increased to an incredible £1,700,000 by 1938.
You could be forgiven for thinking that Radio Normandy resided in majestic surroundings with marble hallways. But it wasn't quite like that, as Bob Danvers-Walker explains.
The studio as such, it was a hayloft over a stable. A sloping roof, the walls padded with an old carpet or sections of carpet to dampen the sound. We were right beneath the big bell tower of the Benedictine structure, which is a most ornate building. Down below was where the coach and horses used to be, but was now converted by the French people into an office for their little typists and secretaries and so on. Now, in the middle of that floor, they had one of these old blackjack stoves. I don't know if you know what I mean by that. That was where it has to be. It's a cast iron thing, you know, enormous great thing with a chimney going up through the centre of the roof. And every once in a while, they would offload coal into this thing, you see. Well, now, there was no soundproofing as such. So whenever we opened the microphone to stop the clatter of typewriters, and also they're loading coal on because they like to get a good head of steam up, you know, you know what the French people are like, everything boiling hot. So we would have to open the door and down say, silence, s'il vous plaît, you see, and then we would open the microphone, make our announcement, particularly when the important commercial was going over, you see, finish this, pop on the gramophone record, and then said, lazy, and then they hammer away on their typewriters or heat the coals on the fire.
We're off to Reading, hooray, hooray, at Huntley and Palmer's to spend the day. We're longing to reach this wonderful town, to taste their biscuits so crisp and brown. All hot from the ovens before us displayed, we see how these world-famous biscuits are made. And now for our breakfast, dinner and tea, the biscuits we must have are H and P.
It all still sounds rather professional, if not dated, but the announcers working at the station carried out their duties under great stress sometimes. After all, there were no electric gramophones or tape recorders, so how did they manage to put out pre-recorded programmes? Well, for a start, all the programming was on a disc.
Putting on hand-wound gramophones, no less. And we would have to put these breakable 78 RPM discs on, and away we would go during our transmission times. Well, the success of these things was so fantastic. The south of England was our stamping ground. People would tune into Radio Normandy because that was when people used to, what they used to call, search the ether. This was twiddly old knobs of their set and pick up stations from all over the continent. And the better the set, the further they could range. When they heard these English programs, particularly as the BBC was not on the air, they would tune into these things like crazy, because we put out the kind of things that Radio 1 now and local commercial radio puts out ad nauseum, all the pop music from beginning to end of our transmission times. But, of course, we did expand, and in no time at all, from those earliest beginnings, grew literally an empire. Now, ultimately, during the time, the 9 years I think it was that I was there before the war killed it, I was responsible for installing and establishing commercial radio programs from 9 different stations. Apart from Fécamp, there was Toulouse. They sent me down to the south of France to open up on Toulouse. There was Poste Parisien in Paris. There was Radio Lyon. There was then the Spanish circuit opened up. In 34, just before the Spanish Civil War, because I was there 2 revolutions before it, in Madrid. And that is a hairy-chested moment, I don't mind telling you. So there was Radio Madrid, San Sebastian, Barcelona, and Valencia. So that being responsible for all those was quite a thing. And by the time the war happened, when war broke out, the commercial radio network was an intensely important one, and of course we had by that time entered into the field of recorded programs, and that was when the company formed the subsidiary, the Universal Programs Corporation, and ultimately I was brought over then to engage in the presentation of these far more elaborate productions that were first of all on gramophone record, acetates, non-breakable record, and then, of course, slowly into, film, 35mm film, because we had installed in Radio Normandy Western Electric soundheads, 2 cinema camera projectors, as you'd find in the projection room of a cinema. Enormous great things, you see, because the soundtrack on there was the only thing part of the film, 35mm film used, just the soundtrack. And so programs would be recorded, and it was the Horlicks Hour and the Ovaltinis, the Bolito Stockings programs, and many of the major sponsors would have their programs put on to this film. And so these things would be sent over. Well, we had then to become, because not only were we just the announcers, we were also the engineers, we were also the production program designers, we had to do the office work, we had to do everything. It was work, eat, sleep, work, eat, sleep. That was the pattern of our thing. And the loss of announcers who came over there thinking they were only going to be announcers, they saw no joy in life at all. And they used to fall by the wayside. We used to send them back in shiploads.
The expansion of the IBC in Europe had not gone unnoticed by the BBC, who incidentally had been broadcasting in England since the early 1920s. And at one time, the BBC had asked the post office not to hire facilities to stations whom they considered to be pirates. By the mid-30s, 10 stations around Europe were transmitting IBC's brand of light entertainment.
They'll soon be blowing by, by the rainbow up in the sky. Whoa, what, da-da-da-da. When it seems that you're going to win, you're on the outside looking in.
I like that, didn't you? Thank you, Joan. Thank you, Wendy. Thank you, Kay. Now, I'm going to sing the number that I've been asked for more than any other since I've been singing on the air. And I think it's my own favorite, too. Little man, you've had a busy day.
Little man, you're crying. I know why you're blue. Someone took your kitty car away. Better go to sleep now, little man. You've had a busy day.
Les Allen's Piano Requests, a popular program in its day. The new medium had attracted a considerable amount of artists from the theatrical and variety fraternity. Names who appeared on sponsored shows at the time included
Arthur Askey,
Clapham and Dwyer,
Tommy Trinder,
Donald Pears,
and Tessie O'Shea.
As far as the announcers were concerned, if anyone had an idea for improving the service, they were greeted with open arms. Most of the time, anyway. Roy Plumley, who later became famous for his Desert Island Discs on the BBC, was one such person. As an up-and-coming actor, he approached Radio Normandy with an idea for the station, but didn't get quite the reception he'd anticipated.
I was interviewed by the boss, the general manager, Richard Mayer, who became my boss and a very, very good radio man indeed. And he listened to my idea and said, it's absolutely splendid, but we haven't got the technical resources, and it's much, much too expensive. And I was looking at my notes for this thing the other day, and it is still an excellent idea. There are now the technical resources, but it's still much too expensive. But having got that out of the way, he then gave me some time and began to talk about commercial radio and its problems, in which I was naturally interested. And he said that one of the problems was that there were just four chaps living in this small community, this small northern French fishing port, Fécamp. And in the winter, things got a bit morose. There was no English colony. They were on their own, and there were crises of temperament and alcohol, and they found it terribly hard to keep staff. And in fact, he said, we're minus an announcer at the moment. Do you happen to know anybody? And I said, well, there's me, because I happened to be out of work at the time, as most young actors seem to spend most of their time out of work. And he said, fine, well, you shall have an audition. So I was sent a day or two later up to the UPC Studios, which was the production unit of IBC, with Hayhap Studios, a recording studio in Kilburn High Road. It had been the studios used by a disc firm called Sterno, which had gone off the market. And I found that there were three others waiting for the audition. And I thought, oh, well, this is no good. I thought it was just going to be me. If there's competition, I'm out for a start. There was a young actor who's still around called Peter Bennett. And there was a man who said that he was He had been the Paris representative of Punch, and to this day I can't imagine what Punch needed a Paris representative for. And then there was a man whose name I forget, who afterwards ran a recording studio in London. And I went into the studio in my turn, and they gave me some stuff to read and some ad-lib announcements to make. And the man taking the audition was Tom Ronald, who afterwards became one of the senior light entertainment producers of the BBC and had done his stint for years on Radio Normandy. And at the end of it, after I'd done it, he came out of the control room and said, thank you very much. And I said, thank you very much. And I went home. And when I got home, there was a telephone call. Why haven't I waited? They wanted to see me. So I went back the next day, and they said they wanted to make a record. They liked what I'd done, but they wanted to make a disc to play to the bosses. But the recording channel had broken down, so I couldn't make a record. But they sent me to a recording studio in Baker Street. And, well, I got the job. And off I went to Fécamp, seen off by all my actor friends. I'd actually got a permanent job. This was going to run. I was on a month trial. Well, that was a month's work. That was pretty good. That was security.
But that month's security turned into several years. It was not long after finding his feet at Fécamp for Radio Normandy that he was asked to set up the station at Poste de Parisienne in Paris.
I was on my own. I had an office in the Champs-Élysées. I had an expense account. And except on Sundays, when I had to work quite hard, I just had half an hour's transmission a day on Poste Parisienne. Well, an evening from 10:30 to 11, either I played records from the studio or I compared the cabaret from a Paris nightclub. Very pleasant job. Rather wish I had it now. But obviously I was ambitious, and after about 6 months they suggested I went to London and became a producer and produced programs for Radio Normandy, Poste Parisien, and well, occasionally some of our stuff got onto Luxembourg too, although they mostly worked independently.
Many of the variety shows were recorded at live venues up and down the country. To do this, IBC set up an outside broadcast, or OB unit, and eventually had three vans converted for recording purposes. Roy Plumley was assigned this task as well.
I became the OB man. We had a lot of outside broadcasting. This was a development that happened in about 1937. We had our first IBC outside broadcast truck, very heavy with a lot of equipment in it, to do what could nowadays be done with a small tape recorder. And then afterwards we had a more elaborate one, and these lorries were put up on jacks, and wax discs were cut outside in the alley. And we'd recorded in cinemas. We recorded cinema organ programs with instrumentalists and soloists, and we used to record from especially recorded specially staged variety programs from cinemas. We had our own road show on the air, a touring review, Radio Normandy Calling, and I used to follow that round. I used to judge the amateur talent competition on Thursday night and then record a half-hour show on Fridays. That in particular was the Alhambra Bradford. But we went all round the country on that, including some dates in the Midlands where, of course, they couldn't receive Radio Normandy because Radio Normandy blanketed the prosperous South. That was our advertising slogan. And indeed, reception was terrifically good in the South. It wasn't bad in the North, but it was disastrous in the Midlands. So any Midland dates they we used to play, they used to look at the posters and say, Radio Normandy, what's that then?
Well, yes, you know what that means. That means your old friend Millennium Bill's on parade. That's a program with lots of fun and some stirring martial music. It comes to you at 11:15 on Sunday morning. Let's listen to Bill for a minute.
No, it's like that. You don't like Maggie's plum duff.
No.
And you don't like her stew.
No.
Do you like Maggie?
Good enough.
Yeah.
Do you like me?
Not much.
Limelight on rhythm. That follows immediately on Millennium Bill, and it's used to make you swing fans pick up your ears. A jam session swung for you by John Collins' Rhythm Six with the husky, fascinating hotcher of Dinah Miller, the personality girl.
Some of the variety shows which were recorded were not staged specifically for radio, and it follows that many of the acts were visual. So how was this problem overcome?
Radio is a blind medium, and that was a radio man's job, to make the thing live, to put the new dimension on it, the other dimension on it, to make it visual. So there's a great deal of that. Possibly there isn't enough today, but we used to describe what people were wearing. And, of course, if you were describing a theatre show, you had to describe the colour of the sets and the costumes and give as good a word picture as you possibly could.
And here are the five Sherry brothers, and they really are brothers. They're all tall and dark, and they look very much alike, and in this scene, they're wearing evening dress. They're an incredibly versatile bunch of people. During the show, they've been dancing and playing instruments and doing sketches, and now you're going to hear them singing. Two of them, by the way, have got a violin and a guitar. And so, Black Paul has said goodnight, and we have to thank McLean's Limited for our visit. Good night, everybody. From the whole cast of Lawrence Wright's On With The Show Company and your commentator, Roy Plumley.
Well, it sounded as though they were having fun, but was it as much fun for the announcing staff?
Oh, much more fun, much more fun. Because there were fewer people involved. You did the whole job yourself. It was a much more creative job because there was nobody telling you what to do. At Normandy, for example, we put the transmitter on the air, we pulled all the switches and the plugs and whatever to get the thing going. We were right away from the French part of the business. They were across the road. And, as I say, there were only four of us to do the whole 75 hours or whatever it was a week. And there were only one or two of us on duty at a time, and we were on our own. We did our own light engineering, our own running repairs, we played our own discs, we got our own discs off the shelves and put them away again, we chattered away, we wrote or ad-libbed most of the stuff, and providing you stayed reasonably sober and providing you sounded as if you enjoyed it, you were doing all right. We were talking about this rather complicated business. You had this control table with six turntables on it, and some of it was a little bit hairy. For example, when you were doing sponsored stuff, which carried, of course, money, and money was what the program was about, they wanted you to do that well. You might, for example, on one turntable have been finishing the signature tune of a fully recorded program from London. When that came to an end, you had to whip off the needle. No styluses in those days, needles. You had to keep changing needles. And then you would do station identification. You said, this is Radio Normandy broadcasting on a wavelength of whatever it was. Having given the station identification signal, which was hitting four notes on a little xylophone, which was on the control desk, you then gave a time signal, which was a little bit approximate. You hit a gong, giving the time off a clock on the wall, which wasn't a very accurate clock. We then whipped on the next disc, which was the signature tune for the following program. We then had to fade that out and crossfade to some recorded dialogue done in London. And from the recorded dialogue, which was introducing a disc, we had to go to that disc. And while that disc were playing, we put away the discs we'd been using and laid out the next two or three discs that we were going to use. And sometimes we were only using bits and pieces. We were going in and out on chalk marks and whatever. So you had to keep your wits about you.
But if the station announcer wasn't on the ball, then there were dire consequences, with the announcer being none too popular, as Bob Danvers Walker explains.
Visualize a whole orchestra, Mantovani, and solo artists coming into a studio to make a series of programs. And all the announcing of the items, and of course the commercial in the middle of the program, all that had to go on to this gramophone record. So everything had to be right. You couldn't stub your tongue and then start again. You'd literally have the whole thing right from the beginning and start again. And now you can imagine what an announcer, particularly right at the end, when he'd have to say, this program has come to you through the courtesy of DDD. This is a commercial in itself. I believe it still exists. But it's a face lotion against pimples and acne. And you come up, and if you made a boo-boo on that, a mess-up of that announcement, you'd have to go right the way back and start all over again with In a Monastery Garden and heaven knows what, whatever the programme comprises.
Not all of the programmes were of a complete musical nature. IBC also produced magazine programmes in London for transmission from Normandy. Radio Luxembourg was also transmitting some of IBC's programme material, but during the late 30s set up their own organisation in London. Programmes for Sunday on Radio Luxembourg included the Philips Live Yeast Concert, presented by Christopher Stone, who previously was the BBC's first disc jockey. Then there was the Rinso Concert. And let's not forget the Bile Beans broadcast, which was in fact a programme of the latest dance music. Their slogan was something to the effect of, "She can slim and stay fit while she sleeps with nightly doses of Bile Beans." And that is absolutely true.
Now, if you thought that problem pages were something originating from the swinging 60s, you'd be wrong. A problem page of the air was broadcast by Radio Normandy long before Anna Raeburn was even a sunspot in her father's eye.
And now, here's another problem letter. A listener writes this to me. "Dear Les Allen, I've got the gramophone record you made of Love Will Find a Way. I often play it, but although you sing it so nicely, it makes me feel so sad. You see, the words make me look in the mirror and wish I was so much more attractive. My hair just seems dull and ordinary, and..."
Wait a minute, Les. This is one of your letters that I'm going to reply to.
Okay.
I know the right answer. In fact, I've given it in this program already. Let me advise this listener and all the others to write for today's Snowfire free sample. The Snowfire Tinted Wave Set. There's one packed up ready to be posted to you. Write and tell us which shade you want. Natural, blonde, auburn or brunette. It'll make dull-looking hair lovely again. It'll make the setting of your curls and waves easier, natural-looking, and longer-lasting. Let me tell you the address again. Snowfire, Hampshire Limited 22, Derby. Enclosed tuppence in stamps for postage, and you'll receive the Snowfire Tinted Wave Set to bring out the natural gleaming tones of your hair.
Thank you.
Times may change, but problems, particularly teenage problems, don't. Up until 1937, Radio Normandy had been using a frequency of 269 metres on the medium wave band. Unfortunately, this wavelength suffered some interference, so it was decided to change to a clearer channel further along the wave band. Radio Normandy acted with the speed of light and made sure everyone knew about it.
"Franklin, about the wavelength change. You'd better shelve all other work and get ready to codify results under the new wavelength. We've asked for reception reports and the field test vans out. Some of our clients will be letting us have sample replies for analysis, and we'll want maps as soon as possible for day and night coverage."
"Cartwright?"
"Cartwright, on the subject of this wavelength change.
Yes.
Everybody's been notified, of course, but I want you account executives to give your clients an extra call.
Right.
And see if you can give them any extra service.
Shall we?
Warn those who are printing merchandising material, you know, show cards and so on.
Yes.
And the ones that have spent a lot of money on posters and bus sides, you better tell them we'll be ready with stickers if they want them."
"Right you are."
"That you, Hargreaves?"
"Yes, I heard about you. You look surprised.
How's the Christmas card record?"
"Oh, the greeting side's recorded. We're doing the publicity side on Monday."
"Oh, well, I wonder if we couldn't devote that second side to the wavelength too."
Radio Normandy's change to 274 metres meant that reception would become stronger and generally clearer. and they were now using a transmitter with a power of some 150 kilowatts. By 1937, commercial radio had reached its pinnacle, and an international broadcast club, which had been set up in 1932 for listeners, had some 320,000 members by the outbreak of war in 1939. A monthly news magazine was published giving details of IBC's programmes from Europe, and that would have cost you 2 pence, later 3 pence. Inflation is nothing new.
One of the children's heroes of the day was Uncle Benji, broadcaster Bernard McNab under another guise. His popular Odeon Theatre show captivated the young audience each week with stories of everyone's favourite naughty girl, Flossie, and told stories of his visits to Hollywood, which were, incidentally, a complete fabrication.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, Odeon Theatres have pleasure in introducing Bernard McNab, more commonly known as Uncle Benji, to Radio Normandy listeners. Matter of fact, I don't think he needs much introduction. Well, Uncle Benji, after he left the station some months ago, took a flying trip to Hollywood. And here he is back again to give you his personal impression of that glamorous city. Come on, Benji.
Hello, Tom.
Hello, everybody.
Well, it's grand to be back here to talk to you all again. And I don't want to tell you all the very obvious bits of news about Hollywood, because I'm sure that most of you know them all by heart. But there's one subject that I'm very keen on. You all hear about Greta Garbo refusing to give those press interviews and the number of girls Clark Gable has fallen in love with, but nobody ever mentions the most important features in the Hollywood fraternity, and that is baby stars.
I say it's a great pity that Flossie and I didn't go over with you. You know, I rather think that Flossie would make a good film star. You know, she's terribly keen about, what's that kid's name, Shirley Temple.
Oh, yes. Well, as a matter of fact, so am I. I'm awfully keen on Shirley Temple. I saw her at work, as a matter of fact, on a new film the other day.
Bernard McNab was also a station announcer in his time, and was, among other things, responsible for putting on the weekly soap operas. But there was one time when things didn't go quite to plan.
Stella Dennis. That was the famous one. It used to go on every Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock sharp until about 3, because it was two sides of a 16-inch 33 and a third. And it meant about 35 minutes one side, 35 minutes the other side. And when we did the flip over, we did the commercial station announcement, and we put the other side on. And so we thought we would kids in. One day we thought, well, there we are. We'd had this Stella Dennis going for a long time. This time we'll put the needle on, and we'll go down to a little cafe on the corner and have ourselves a glass of beer or coffee. And we timed our watches. We thought, well, we'll come back and it will be all right in time to turn the record over. When we came up the stairs, we heard a little repeating noise going on. So it said, stop, don't shoot. Stop, don't shoot. Stop, don't shoot. Rushed in. And there was the thing about a third way through the first side, and it was stuck in a groove. So we faded it out quickly. We turned the record over and put on the second side because we were going to run short of time. Nobody noticed anything going wrong. They must have been very entranced with that particular production.
Say, I know a bundle of humanity. She's about so high, and I'm nearly driven to insanity when she passes by. She's a snooty little cutie. She's been so hard to kiss. I'll try to overcome her vanity, and then I'll tell her this. I'm young and healthy, and you've got charms. It really is sin not to have you in my arms. I'm young and healthy, and for you, when the moon is in the sky, tell me what am I to do. Say, if I can hate you, I'd keep away. But that ain't my nature. I'm full of vitamin A. Say, I'm young and healthy, so let's be bold.
Young and Healthy from the great musical 42nd Street, sung by Dick Powell. By the late 30s, Radio Luxembourg was producing all its own material and had broken away from the IBC stable. Luxembourg had started one of the phenomenally successful cults of the time, the Ovaltinis.
The Ovaltinis were certainly the most popular of the radio groups, probably because they were children, but more about them later. Making a commercial presented all sorts of problems. Most were read or sung live. More adventurous ones were pre-recorded on those rather clumsy discs. Usually, the agency or company handling the advertising account would draw from its ranks actors and actresses to play the necessary parts. But even that had its problems, as former radio actress Betty McNabb explains.
I was Maggie, that's right, I was Maggie in the canteen, who did the tea and everything else for all the workmen. And that's why I had to be as all cockney. what was the other one? Oh, the other one was somebody's syrup of figs. And a very well-known actress, since dead, Mary O'Farrell. And she was Nurse Johnson, and I was her sister. And most of the program was all about my two children, who seemed to be permanently constipated. we were always suggesting various things. Well, the somebody said of a figs. What was it called? I can't remember now. Never mind. But because of the gist of the program, there was very little that we could do without just doubling up with laughter. And they were always having to re-record, because we laughed so much.
And laughter was the key, and not only laughter, but also the general cheery chat and pop music of the day.
But the cheery chat and music from the commercial stations couldn't detract the general public's attention from what was happening elsewhere in Europe. Some people were preaching a different message in the form of revolution, violence, bigotry, hatred, and war.
Ich für eine Kirche der Voller, als der Kampf konfessioneller politischer Verbände, die in ihrer koalitionsbedingten Kompromisspolitik personelle Vorteile für Parteianhänger stets erkaufen müssen mit der ideellen Preisnahme einer wirklich innerlich religiösen Erziehung.
Hitler, who even appointed a minister of propaganda.
Während der andere auf dem Höhepunkt einer fantastischen und hier märchenhaft anmutenden politischen Erfolgsbahn nun im Begriff stand, die ganze Macht und die ganze Verantwortung in seine zwar jungen, aber starken Hände hineinzunehmen.
Herr Goebbels, who didn't attract much affection from the French or British. Now, Radio Normandy, which was later renamed Radio International, gave out counterblasts of political propaganda, perhaps a case of if you can't beat 'em, join 'em. But this was the beginning of the end for commercial radio in Europe. Bob Danvers Walker.
Now, this was virtually the death knell, sounded the death knell of Radio Normandy, or Radio International, because I was responsible for pumping out some pretty hefty replies to Dr. Goebbels, the Nazi Minister of Propaganda, and Lord Haw-Haw, who were pumping out there from their end of the war. They were pushing out all this propaganda, and I had to do the same thing as counterblasts to these, you see. And they were very successful, which may be measured by the fact that German aircraft came over. Because they used to get a fix. They used to line up to be able to get their navigation right. This sounds unbelievable. They used to get a sort of cross-reference between Radio Normandy, Radio Calais, and BBC on one of their wavelengths. And they'd sort of get a cross-reference and know where they were. This is absolutely true for planting magnetic mines in Le Havre Harbour. And so the French rapidly caught on to this effect, to how these stations, or this particular station, was helping the Germans in their war effort. And so they said, that's it, we've got to close it down. And bang, that was the finish of it. But it was not until just after the war, after the liberation of Paris, I was over there at the time, that I heard that the Gestapo had come in to Fécamp. I was up in the north of France by that time, on the Maginot Line, as a war correspondent.
And they had the whole of my dossier, the whole case, my history, my family history, because all this had to be given when I got a work permit, you see, in the first place. And there was Fifth Column operating at the in Fekau at that time. So the whole of my dossier, my past history, was known to the Germans. And, of course, they had recordings of my voice taking body blows at their head, Dr. Goebbels. And so they said, where is this man? Because they captured one of our chief engineer. When they said captured, he said, oh, this thing's going to blow over, and I don't mind. I've got my wife and kid over here, and I'm going to stay in Fekau. He did, and he got into a concentration camp, and his wife too. Anyway, they grilled him. And they were saying, but where is this man who said these nasty things, he says. So I'm rather glad we won the war.
So were we. But now the time was 1939, and the clouds of war which had gathered over Europe finally broke into the most violent man-made storm the world has ever seen.
The horror of war was brought home to the British people for the second time in less than 25 years. Across the Channel, the Germans either destroyed or confiscated the transmitting equipment, and the IBC broadcasting stations were never heard again.
But the Germans did find a use for the transmitters at Radio Luxembourg. But it wasn't the sweet sound of the children's voices with the Ovaltini's half hour. The Nazis had a more sombre message with an equally sombre commentator.
Germany calling, Germany calling, Germany calling. Here are the Reichsender ambush, station Bremen and station VXB on the 31-meter band. You are about to hear our news in English.
The New York Times reports the British cruiser Exeter has been run aground near Port Stanley on the east coast of the Falkland Islands. This American newspaper states that the Exeter has been so severely damaged by the artillery of the Admiral Graf Spee, that it is impossible to make the ship seaworthy again. As some of the guns of the Exeter are still in good working order, the British Admiralty obviously intends to make use of the hulk as an additional coastal battery at Port Stanley.
William Joyce, an Irish-American whom the Daily Express branded Lord Haw-Haw. Joyce once said that the German people had the spark of life in them.
Spark or not, his brand of propaganda certainly inflamed his British audience. But most people found it all highly amusing. Who else would have dared speak about the British Ministry of Misinformation? There's no doubt Joyce did Herr Goebbels proud. But after the war, he was hanged for his trouble, for treason.
When Germany was in the throes of total defeat, Joyce made his famous farewell speech, somewhat slurred, shortly after 5 o'clock one spring afternoon.
And therefore I say to you, in these last words, you may not hear from me again for a few months. I say, es liebe Deutschland, Heil Hitler, and farewell.
And that was the last we heard of William Joyce. The war years had seen vast changes in the pattern of broadcasting at home and abroad. The BBC started the famous World Service, which is still going strong to the five corners of the earth today.